Okay, so please get him when in one of the breaks. Thank you very much, Mike, for the keynote that set the day and the track and the whole conference. The mood of that. And as Mike said, the conference, when you also mentioned that the first conference was chosen, the location was chosen with NIST in mind, NIST location in mind. So it's a symbiotic relationship, I should say. So we appreciate your time and your effort in helping us come up to speed with what you do. And we also enjoy the information that you give us. So the next talk is, the topic is third-party security validation, the role of FIPS 140-2, CC, which is common criteria, and UCAPL, and in securing products. And our speaker is John Morris, is the president of CARSEC. I don't have your bio data here, but I've worked with him in the past, and he's another nice person to work with. And I will let John talk about himself a little bit and then present us. And this would be the last one for the morning session, after which we have lunch, and then there is the rest of the sessions. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Nithya.
Did you find it?
Yeah. So good morning, everybody. Thank you for taking the time to both come to the conference and to listen to this presentation. And I hope you'll find it helpful and valuable. But I want to tell you what my goals are, so both you'll know what to expect, as well if you need to switch to a different one really quickly, you can. But my goal is not to provide a whole bunch of technical information and to inundate you with details and that kind of thing. I can do that, obviously, and there's a wealth of that kind of information in FIPS 140-2 and common criteria in the DoD's approved product list process. And you can ask questions as well. Feel free to interrupt me if you want something specifically. But my goal is to try and tie these three together, give you some intro and overview as to what these programs are, and more importantly, how we're using them, and spur some food for thought, get some thinking on why we're using them, what we're doing, and what we as a community in this conference can actually do to improve these programs, improve the processes that we're talking about. And I think you heard that theme in the keynotes today as well. Mike Cooper, I thought, gave a really good look at that as well, that NIST, working with the program for FIPS 140-2, is trying very hard to provide a program that provides value to the community in general, specifically to their customers. Their customers are government purchasers. So the government purchasers don't want to buy products from the vendors, your products if you're a vendor developer in here, if they aren't meeting the government's requirements for security, specifically around cryptographic engineering requirements. They're serving the government. And Mike also mentioned cybersecurity and what the nation is doing for that. And I don't know if any of you recognize this verbiage here. This is a quote from presidential executive order. And the goal is to ensure that the internet remains valuable for future generations, policies to promote an open, interoperable, reliable, and secure internet that fosters efficiency, innovation, communication, economic prosperity, while respecting privacy and guarding against disruption, fraud, and theft. And you might say, well, mom and apple pie, sure, we want everything to be secure. But this executive order is actually giving direction to the nation, saying, when we're talking about cybersecurity, this is what we mean. And one of the parts of that was follow NIST. It actually said in there, follow what they're saying with this risk framework. Follow what NIAP is doing under these standards. And give me, and it's directed to the agencies, your plans for how you're going to implement that. And if you boil all of that down, part of those plans, part of that risk framework, talks about doing things like third-party assurance for products using FIPS common criteria within the DoD, using things like the DoD-IN APL. So that sentiment that we should be securing these things, it shouldn't be controversial. It should be shared by government and industry alike. Unfortunately, right now, you're seeing with these programs that they're government security programs. Commercial is not demanding FIPS 140-2 in general. Commercial purchasers are not asking if it's been common criteria validated. There are exceptions to this. There was a speaker up earlier talking about smart cards. And in the smart card industry, the banks, they don't have the same government regulation that the federal government has, but they are requiring validations for their products because they have specific concerns around security, specifically that they don't want people stealing money. They want to use smart cards when they're allowing people to transfer funds with that, and they want a certain level of security within that, and they want them evaluated. So they are using programs like Common Criteria to ensure that they have some third-party assurance in there. And thus, it's an economic incentive there that is driving a lot of these activities. We don't want certification because it's a waste of time. We do want certification if it gives value back. So there actually has to be an economic justification for spending all the time and effort that we do with programs like FIPS 140-2. Of course, even if there is value to it, if it's a useful program, unless there's knowledge, unless there's demand from the market, i.e. consumers are saying, I want to purchase products that are validated. I want to purchase products that have been evaluated. I want to purchase products that are on the list. Maybe because I'm required to, and that can be by fiat where the government says you must, or it can be driven by an economic interest where people say, I'm going to have to do that because if I don't, there's a downside to it. I'm going to have people steal money from the banking system. I'm going to have people rip off the IP in my movies. I'm going to have protections in there that are adequate to give me that control on the money flow that's in there. So assuming that vendors are providing products that are meeting certain security standards, how do the consumers know if that's the case? Because there's a wide range of products available for them, from well-designed, secure ones that are expensive to cheap knockoffs from other vendors in other countries, perhaps, that are not providing the same security but are providing similar functionality. And how would an end consumer tell the difference? Obviously, there's been a lot of focus on reputation, branding, and that kind of thing, and marketing often focuses on that, and you want to buy from a reputable vendor. The problem, obviously, that is you put your trust in a well-established company and brand. They may have that brand, but that may not prove that the particular product that you're purchasing from them is going to meet your requirements or not. You have to trust them that they're doing that. That's called first-party assurance. And first-party assurance is the easiest and fastest, the first thing that we all deal with. But most people find that relying on the company to say they have bulletproof security rarely is a long-term strategy for them. Oftentimes we find that the company's claims are run by the marketing department. The engineering department doesn't have a say in what they're actually saying they're doing. And bulletproof security doesn't exist, and it doesn't have any meaning when it comes to cybersecurity. So those first-party claims often don't help. However, you can go and make sure that if you're going to do that, we can do it ourselves. We can look into it more deeply. We can do a second-party assurance. We can go there and say, is this product actually secure? Maybe we read reviews, maybe we evaluate ourselves, maybe we take it into our labs, maybe we prototype it, maybe we go do some testing, maybe we bang on the thing. And those experiences can tell us, do we get the best practice security when we purchase these things? Unfortunately, as I was mentioning, right now there's a difference in sophistication between government and commercial customers. Government customers have decades of experience doing this. So I'm not sure how many of you were involved in the first versions of FIPS 140, FIPS 140-1, but going back to there, it first was a learning experience for many of the government entities and the vendors participating in the labs evaluating in that program. Just as John was mentioning the inventor of Rheindahl of the smart cards, the first evaluations under Common Criteria doing smart cards were not the same level that they are now. They were much more rudimentary. There were bigger flaws within that community. However, as they developed, they got better and better with that. And that consumer, the banking industry, got more experience in demanding what they wanted from those smart cards. So they evolved the standard. And I want to talk about that as a focus, because you've heard almost every speaker coming up here talking about how we evolve the standard. the theme of the conference so far doesn't seem to be abolishing the standard. People aren't saying, let's get the torches, storm the castle, and burn it down. They're saying we need to change it and evolve it, and I would agree with that. And one of the evolutions that's needed is actually something that everyone at this conference is driving, and that evolution is setting the requirements for what is it that we're trying to get out of this. And part of that is done by saying what your frustrations are with the damages caused by products currently that are validated but are not meeting the requirements, whether, as Mike Cooper was pointing that out, because of the particular product there, the cryptographic module within a program, within a set of systems, or whether it's with a larger system where the standards and testing that we're doing is not addressing the gaps between the components or not addressing the larger functionality of the system and missing what's going on in there. So, are consumers demanding security? Well, when it comes to that, we often have to talk about the third-party assurance, because consumers cannot demand security. They can't go through and say, I want to buy from only secure companies. Which are the secure companies? Is it Cisco? They have a great reputation. They do a ton of work from it, and they have a keynote here. Is it Microsoft? Do they spend more dollars than anybody else in security infrastructure because they're so large? Who is the company that's making the good thing? Or is it the specialized security vendors, and you all know their names, their brand names? They're the ones that provide the security because they spend a lot on it. Or is it the new product that's actually coming out there designed to protect and address these flaws? So we can move from questions on this COTS commercial off-the-shelf product that we have to buy. We're not buying specifically made products for our solutions. How can we tell if it's well-built? How can we distinguish snake oil salesmen telling us it's bulletproof from what the actual security requirements we have are? Well, we can't do a first-party claim, can't rely on the vendor. We can't do a second-party claim because we don't have the expertise, especially in the commercial community. And even if we do in the government community, what the government has found over the decades is that there isn't enough time and money and resources to be able to evaluate all the products. It would be nice to spend a year looking into the details of how a product works, but we can't do that for the product that just came out a month ago because we're evaluating whether we should use it to solve the need that we have right now. Thus, the need for third-party claims. And what we're talking about, FIPS 14-2, Common Criteria, and DoD's efforts under the what used to be the UCAPL, now is the DoD and APL, that these are all third-party assurance programs. And that third-party assurance, we go through and we have somebody look at the cryptographic engine or the security engine or the architecture underneath. Obviously, products are designed with security in mind. Obviously, products include security. The most basic product out there probably throws in OpenSSL and has complex and robust cryptography built into it. Whether it actually uses that cryptography, whether it implements it correctly, whether they hard code keys or not, these things are not immediately obvious. And to an end consumer, it's almost impossible to distinguish and tell until you really get into the details. You have to open up the hood and you have to dig in and you have to be a qualified mechanic. And anyway, you can't actually do that. Academic research says have a great difficulty in looking into products and hacking if they don't have access to the architecture, the code, the design of the product. If you do have all of those things, if you do have the shop manual and you do have the car and you do have permission to go and spend some time with it, then you can go in there and evaluate whether or not it's running correctly. Then you can go in there and measure, is it providing that assurance? And that's everything that we're supposed to be doing with FIPS 14-2. That's the whole point of Common Criteria. That's the goal of the DoD's, with one exception that we'll talk about later, programs as well. Okay? And these are the largest and best established programs. There's nothing magical about these programs. CoreSec, what we do is we help vendors go through certification programs, so we're consultants helping people start to finish. So we work with these programs. We work with these programs because they're the biggest ones, thus the most commercially attractive for us to work with. But we're also looking at lots of others, and there are lots of others. The interesting thing with programs, though, is that they have a life cycle. And the biggest ones are the ones that have been out there for a long time and have been actually validated in terms of they've been used by vendors. Vendors have gone through it, and they've made changes to make it a viable program. A program typically doesn't succeed in the first 3 years. You can have a new testing program, and everyone looks at it and says, should I do this or should I not? And people look at it and say, does it provide any value to me or not? that program may be not participated in by enough people and die from lack of critical mass, even if it could have been a potentially valuable program delivering security or value in security to its end users. So these three programs, they share some key components. They are not classified programs. They have published criteria. You can go on the web, you can download all the criteria for these, and you can read through them. And as a vendor preparing to go through this, you can do exactly that and see if your product, or even better, your proposed product design, would meet these requirements. Of course, as a vendor, you would only be going through that process if you're saying, my goal is to get that certification on there. I need that stamp for some reason. I need to get my product past this mark. The components that they share also include third-party testing laboratories. Now, within the DoD, they're DoD entities, but they're independent from the certifying body. Okay, so third-party testing laboratories, in both FIPS and Common Criteria, they're commercial testing laboratories. This means that the people implementing the standards, the vendors, are different from the people testing if those standards have actually been implemented and met, are different from the people that are saying, we certify, we stamp, we approve, we tell you that indeed those steps were followed, someone looked at this, and this meets these requirements. And that's a pretty complex system to go put a stamp on there. It's not voluntary where you go and say, hey, my product meets these requirements. And it's not simple where a purchaser, a second party assurance, can come through and say, you know, I'm going to make sure that your product meets the requirements. If I'm buying ball bearings from somebody and I'm going to say, yeah, I want quality ball bearings. I use that because my kids are playing with spinners. I don't know if you've seen this, this is the latest fad. Those ball bearings, they can be really bad or they can be really good. And you can't tell the difference in those ball bearings when you purchase them. They all look the same, they spin similarly, and they sound the same. But they have standard bearing standards, you know, ABEC 1, ABEC 2, ABEC 3. You can actually measure the physical properties of that. And large purchasers of those, like a skateboard company, they'll specify, we want good bearings, and then they won't accept good bearings from a manufacturer until they actually take them in-house, run them through the sets of tests, and say, yes, this product that you delivered to me meets my specifications, I'll accept it. Otherwise, although you delivered it to me and although I paid for it, it's going back and you're going to return it. Nobody returns products based on security right now. In fact, nobody demands products, with few exceptions, the government being one of them, meet these requirements before they even purchase them. So having accreditation bodies and a process that you go through that proves that these products meet the requirement, all common to what we're dealing with here. The problem is it's a very, very difficult landscape that we're talking about. We're talking about what, cryptographic modules when it comes to FIPS 140-2? Explaining to someone even what those are is difficult. It's not the product. Mike Cooper was talking about that difference for consumers who are trying to purchase these government entities, for instance, saying, I don't understand if this product that I want to buy is FIPS 140-2 validated or not. Why? Well, they say it's got a cryptographic module in there, and that was validated, and that's a piece of software, and I think that's FIPS 140-2 validated, so it's secure, right? Well, it is, but the product actually has multiple cryptographic modules in there, and they do different functions within there. So the authentication is actually done using some TLS protocols and PKI that's implemented in two open source ones, and those are software. But the key management where we do the encryption over here is done in a hardware and a TPM that's inside. Oh, which one of those needed FIPS 140-2? Well, all of them. Well, which one did you validate? Well, I did validate all of them. But you then pass the stuff around in between. The product then exposes all the key material. And that's what one of the other speakers was talking about, that problem where if you go through and you say, great, it's secured, but then I'm going to have somebody else develop an app that's going to put the keys in there and work with it. Well, then who's looking at that? And so one of the problems I think we have in these programs, and it's endemic to them and it's in part of all three, is nobody is looking at the bigger landscape and saying, I want to make sure, and Mike Cooper actually alluded to this as well, that the validation that I'm delivering to you will be valuable to you when you make your purchasing and deployment decisions on the whole product. It sure would be nice if we had a good housekeeping seal of approval on products that said, if you buy and put this product in, you won't be hacked. Obviously, we cannot get there, but we could get to the stage where we say, if you put this product in, it has been tested to the level that we all agree currently in this standard is the unhackable, or at least the hack resistant that meets the best practices of the industry. So although no product can be completely secure, this product is currently secure against all of these types of things that we are worried about. And this would be the ideal. I could promise to you that if you, a vendor, spend, call it $50,000 to $500,000 to $5 million, whatever the level of effort is, on doing this validation effort for this product, then you will have done everything that is the accepted state of the art in the industry. And then your customers can have faith that when they purchase your product, it has a reasonable level of hack resistance or a reasonable level of cybersecurity. In fact, that reasonable and prudent level, that's what we do in a bunch of other industries. Okay, so if you think about building code, we were talking in the first session, Matt Keller, my coworker, is saying, hey, there were fires and they had fire code. You go look at building and fire code, most of the building and fire code is arcane, weird, crazy, doesn't apply to the latest building materials, is a pain for contractors to deal with. But it's there for a specific reason. It's there because it's supposed to save lives. And they know that because they've dealt with disasters like that fire. They've dealt with disasters like building collapses. And what they've done is they've come back and said, this standard, our building code, didn't prevent against this kind of thing. In this environment where there are gale force winds, or we're building up above 1,000 feet, and the flex from this environment, earthquake, they're not protecting against that. But we do have industry standards where if they built in this fashion and used these fasteners, then we would be protected against that. New building code. So we're going to evolve the standard. We're going to issue a more restrictive building code that prevents against that specific type of disaster, such that now consumers, usually local government municipalities, say that I don't have to worry about these kinds of threats, electrical fires, fires where there aren't sprinkler systems to suppress it so that people can get out quickly, buildings falling down under high wind conditions or earthquakes. We have all of those things built into our code, and we accept the cost, because it is significant, of building to meet that code because it will save lives. We actually don't have that for security. That's the landscape we're dealing with now. There is no measurement of how many millions of usernames and credit card infos and identities it's okay to have stolen. There's no real metrics, really, and in the insurance industry on how much it costs to insure against that, because that insurance cost should be offset by the cost to build that security into a product. Furthermore, the landscape is very difficult for who has control over what. Within the government, it's actually relatively clear. We have different areas, for instance, Department of Commerce, NIST, CMVP, NIAP, also under NSA, those programs, they're running FITSON 40-2 and jointly between them, common criteria. Those apply to sensitive but unclassified products. Okay? In the classified realm, DoD has control of that, but for their unclassified, under DISA, they have military components being produced and they must meet DoDIN APL. Okay, so these are product lists, if you will, that say you have met all of our requirements for testing. Who has aegis over the product that you buy in Best Buy that does network security for you? Who regulates what's an acceptable level of security in that? What do consumers ask for? What do they enforce? Currently nothing. So we have FITSON 40-2. It is a joint standard, US and Canadian, hardware, software, firmware, products. Although really it's implemented as modules, so subcomponents of products. So very, very focused on cryptography, very small. It's mandated. Okay, so a lot of people are usually surprised to find out that it's actually a law in the United States that you purchase only FIPS 140-2 validated products that have cryptography in them in the government. The application of that law is broad. The enforcement of that law is less specific, perhaps. But most people are becoming aware of that by now. We have areas that we focus on within FIPS 140-2, things that we cover, that we are concerned about, that we test against. So these are the things that we're making sure that we don't have problems in physical security, we don't have problems in the way we do cryptographic key management, or that at least it meets the best practices that the government has defined for that. Common Criteria uses a similar model in terms of their evaluation, but it actually provides a language for doing that description of what you're going to evaluate. So we define a target of evaluation instead of saying it's a cryptographic module. We say what we're going to evaluate. And it has a little bit more broad applicability in that you could do a small module, or you could do a large product, or you could even do a system of multiple products. Common Criteria is not run by one nation. It's run by a group of nations. So the common part is the 27, 26, depending how many are signing up. 26, thank you. We lost one. Are signing up for the common recognition of those evaluations. So if you get evaluated by a laboratory in a scheme in one country, it's automatically accepted or recognized by other countries as being a valid evaluation that they could use to make decisions on purchasing for. Okay? So you can actually apply Common Criteria to a wider set of things, and people do it for doorknobs to jet fighters. The international origin of Common Criteria means that it has more applicability for vendors in terms of doing one evaluation and getting accepted in other places. But of course, devil's in the details. There's a lot of wrinkles to that, and there are a lot of regions where Common Criteria is not recognized currently, yet they have similar programs that are inspired by or parallel to Common Criteria to do that kind of evaluation. So the 26 countries that we currently have independent laboratories throughout most of them that are doing this evaluation set. So we have a wide range of products and specialties being evaluated. Of course, some types of products are more focused in some areas. So the smart cards that we're talking about, they're being evaluated primarily in France and Germany, maybe a little bit in England. And those specialties, if you will, are being driven by both U.S. and Canadian standards, but more importantly by groups with a different recognition agreement, SOGIS, in Europe that says here's what the banking industry is demanding for these products. So Common Criteria has a different set of focuses than FIPS 14-2, but it's also similar areas of security concerns. Things functionally that we were worried about, that we want to make sure that people are doing correctly, and that we may be making claims about within our toe to say, here's how we do these things in this product. They also go through areas that are common to FIPS 14-2, like life cycle and development, but in a different way. But they also have areas that are not covered in FIPS 14-2 and can be applied to, as we said, systems as well. DoD has the DoD IN APL, used to be called UC, Unified Capabilities APL. DoD IN is a little bit better name, so talking about information networks. Although I think all of these standards could probably just be labeled cybersecurity these days. Not that it would be clearer, but it would be cooler anyway. And the DoD actually has a little bit different focus in their program in that they have two things that they're doing. Both Common Criteria and FIPS 14-2 test against these standards in a product. So a vendor has to come, show all their documentation, show their design, and get the independent laboratory to test they meet the requirements. Within the DoD, they do that, so they test against security requirements standards, but they also do interoperability testing. So part of the focus for the DoD is within the DoD's networks, within the DoD's domains, we want to make sure that your product plays nicely, and that includes functioning and interacting and interoperating with the other components that are deployed in the DoD networks. And so they both do information assurance testing as well as interoperability testing. But again, these programs cover similar areas, and in fact, they often reference each other. So FIPS 14-2 historically had referenced Common Criteria when it came to operational environment or operating system questions on how to deal with it. They've gone back and forth on how tightly that referencing has been and what happens in there. Common Criteria more recently has been pointing directly to FIPS 140-2 for Common Criteria requirements around cryptographic security, saying if you're going to implement, especially within the US, Canada, and Australia, if you're going to implement these things, these types of things, or make claims about cryptography, then you'll have to back that up with a detailed evaluation, get a validation for FIPS 140-2 for those, or go through the CAVP, cryptographic algorithm validation for those. It's because they're acknowledging that these areas areas are interlocking, that they're not one part of it. DOD, the UCAPL or the DODINAPL, had been going through and saying, we actually require for some types of products that you not only go and meet all of our requirements and get tested, but you come in with, or finish up while you're doing it, a FITS 14-2 validation as well, or a common criteria evaluation, or in some cases, both. So they were saying that it was a subcomponent that they needed that assurance as well to do their program, and they wanted to see some of the evidence that was produced sometimes for those products to say, I want you to show me what you did for that to see that we can meet those requirements for our stuff as well. So these mandates, they go through and tell you, here's what you need to do. Problem is, who wrote those requirements? Who actually designed that? And what is the right path for us to go and do these kinds of evaluations? One thing that we should be as a consumer community or a vendor community or involved in this process is think about what the effective way to use these certifications are. Because our livelihood and our ability to help people through this process depends on whether there's end value brought in it. These requirements are useless, I would posit, unless they're mandated. That mandate can be by fiat, because the government says so and will enforce it, or it can be de facto, because if you don't have it, you won't be accepted commercially in the marketplace. UL listing is one I like to refer to, because we all have these products that plug into the wall, and they're all UL listed. There is no law that says products have to be UL listed, but you will not find a product on the shelves, or you will not find a company that makes products that they sell that is not UL listed for very long. Because insurance companies will not insure a company that makes anything that plugs into the wall unless they get their products all UL listed. Why? If they happen to burn down a house and that product wasn't UL listed, tested against basic problems that would cause house fires with electricity, then they're not going to cover them insurance-wise. That company's going to get sued and put out of business. They're not going to be able to live under market conditions there. So you have to have a backup for the cost of doing the evaluations that is covered more than not by doing by the marketplace rewarding you for having those. Okay. The limitations of these programs, though, the cost and complexity is huge in complying, and the cost and complexity of testing against them is getting more and more difficult. It's more and more regulations, and you actually have to balance that. The biggest problem, though, I think that we can affect right now is product security improvement, obviously, but everyone's working as hard as possible on that. But then there's a lack of a feedback circuit. So yeah, you know, what if you can say build better products? Yeah, no one would argue with that advice. But I can also tell you, change the feedback circuit for what we build against, what we protect against. Some of the esoteric attacks that we talk about are nice to protect against, but they're not real world. They cost a lot to put in, and then we test against them and force vendors to have that in there. Whereas some of the easiest things to break through are not protected against and not required in the standards currently. Like if you all watched the movie Sneakers, it was a great Hollywood take on security. And in the movie, Robert Redford is breaking into a very secure facility to try and steal things from it. And he gets at one point, he's in front of the door and it's got a biometric lock and a keypad. And oh my goodness, it's Hollywood drama and there's music playing. And he gets on the little phone. It's Israeli made. And he gets the instructions on how to break through the very complex lock. And he takes his foot and he goes, bam! And he kicks in the door. Because all of the effort making the lock extremely secure, they ignored the physical security of that door lock and it was weak. You just break in. Well, the feedback circuit is missing in our industry, 100%, I believe. In the banking industry, when they design ATMs, they have problems with skimmers. People come in and put something in front of the ATM, reads the card, watches what your PIN is, they steal that and they go and drain your bank account. But skimmers, they're constantly having the police arrest people for putting skimmers on there, and then they're capturing some of the skimmer technology, and they're figuring out how are they managing to do that. And the feedback loop in that testing program is when they stole money from the bank through those ATM machines with those skimmers, and they found out about it, they go back to the standard and they say, we want to test now that it doesn't have this problem. You know what? We now need a see-through front so you can see if there's additional electronics behind it. You know what? We need to have... and they actually modify the standard to put in real-world protections against break-ins that they've had. That lack of feedback circuit, we're missing. So, WannaCry ransomware, what did we learn from that? I didn't see a single headline saying, hey, these products, they didn't meet this, we're all vulnerable. Where was the FIPS 140-2 validation on the product? Nobody asked that, because no one had the expectation that any of these standards would provide protection against that. I would say that's actually the problem. We need to be coming back and saying, here's the attacks that we had, here's how we need to fix it. Then we can say, well, how long does it take and how much does it cost to put that in, and reduce the complexity of the testing to give us the highest value return on it, to test the things that are important and not to do the other ones. Okay? So I think that kind of feedback is pretty important. And the benefits of programs, putting that baseline of security in there, giving us that extra assurance, and giving consumers, whether it be government or commercial, something to hang their hat on to know, these are the products that meet my baseline security requirements. This is done seriously. This has a basic level of hack-proofness to it that I want, that I'm willing to pay for. That's when it becomes more marketable. That's when we get money back. That's when we say, I'm only going to buy a product that's met these requirements. Okay? So thank you for listening. Sorry for taking you up to lunch. If you have questions, you can contact me. And if you need to know more about anything, just let me know.
Thank you. Again, we just missed. I think everybody is hungry. So if you have any burning question, feel free to ask. I can allow one or two questions if you're okay. Okay, I take it nobody is moving towards the phone. Everybody's moving towards the door. So they might get you at lunchtime. All right. So thank you, everybody. This is lunch, and the lunch is being served in the other side. If you go down, there's an exhibit hall all the way down, and then the restrooms, and past that, there's the exhibit hall. Lunch is served until, lunch is from 12:20 till 20 minutes after 1. So come back. We'll see you then. Thank you once again.